When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Knowing oneself comes from attending with compassionate curiosity to what is happening within. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows, fretting listeners. My name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show, and I am the captain of this hot mess of a ship. A ship. We're on Karen Reed verdict watch, folks. You know, this case came out of nowhere for me. What a nice little treat it's been for however many weeks it is. This was maybe at Johnny Depp, Amber Heard level of entertainment. So, nice little treat here. Moving it along, folks. So today, we are diving deep with a member of the shit show community, Jesse, who I have been bugging the shit out of for a really long time to have him come on the pod. He is, how do I want to describe him? So he's in the process of becoming a trauma coach, and he just knows his shit. He probably knows a lot more than many of our therapists. His shares are just packed full of wisdom in the community. He has a way with words and a way with explaining things, which is why I wanted to have him on to talk about parts work, IFS stuff, and to explain the concept of the fragmented mind that happens from trauma that ends up forming these parts of ourselves. So we recorded together, like, it was like over 4 hours, over 2 days. So what I'm doing here is you're going to get to hear a little bit of his story, but then we're going to go into the meat of the episode. For Shit Show Saturday, you'll get more of the details of his shit show story. So let's move it along, folks. But first, let's talk about why you need to damn the join shit show. I mean, after you hear Jesse today, how could you not want to join? Don't you want to have access to Jesse? I'm pimping you out, dude. Damn the join shit show. This is where I host 4 weekly Zoom support groups. I do just want to say, I haven't said this in a while, this is not an official ACA group. We are not affiliated with them in any way. This is a community where we get really raw and real, but we also get quite silly at times, quite jokey. It's a wild place, okay? It's not for everyone. I'm an acquired taste. I'm aware of that. So yeah, damn the join shit show, okay? See the link in the bio. Next, give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at AdultChildPod, and last but not least, whatever the fuck you do, folks, give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Thank you, love you all. So take me to the or a dark night of the soul.
Well, it's definitely gonna have to be A, because there's plenty of them. So like, I mean, I could briefly say a few of them. One was several years ago after my divorce and everything fell apart then, and a couple multiple times like throughout that relationship, really. Before then, a major event in my mid-20s was when I was suicidal and almost died. And then I was living in Portland and my family showed up and they pretty much like kidnapped me, and then I moved back to the East Coast, and so I lost everything that I had, like all my possessions and my car, and went into a situation that wasn't helpful. That was a turning point. for me, but not for the better. Like, you think it would have been like, get my life together after that. And it was more of rebellion and running away still inside of myself, like still afraid to face why I was so suicidal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Tell me when it clicked for you. When did you realize that this was all a result of your childhood?
That took time in my, like, around the age of 30, a little bit before the age of 30. So like 9, 10 years ago, I decided to go to therapy. And then that therapist was not good.
Is that for your marriage?
Or this this before, right before I met her, pretty much. And then I was going to a natural path. And then they were also could prescribe medication. And then I went through like maybe 15 or 16 different types of medications. Before that, I was on medication too, like SSRI. And then it wasn't until everything broke down in the relationship again. And I moved back to North Carolina for like 2 or 3 months. And at that point, I just spent all my money and went to 2 different therapists. Went to a psychiatrist, trying to figure out what was going on with me, because I knew I couldn't connect in a relationship and kept shutting down and was suicidal. And I didn't know why. And then one of the therapists I was seeing diagnosed me with borderline personality disorder. And they basically said I was like living in a war zone with my family and I needed to get out. And so I moved back to the West Coast, because also they didn't really have facilities to do DBT training in groups. Like, he didn't have access to that. And so he's like, you know, where you're from has a lot of that there. And so I'd moved back. There was a lot of points in my life where it was just like, because of the situation when I was 25, I've just given everything else like up in life, just given everything away and just did something drastic, like move or whatever, because I just didn't care. Mm-hmm. There was no concept of the future or consequences or anything like that. It was all living right in the moment and basically just what I had to do to survive, not knowing that I'm living from a trauma response. I didn't have any concept of trauma. A lot of my therapists had nothing to do with teaching me about trauma. They were diagnosing me and helping me in ways, but it wasn't any trauma language. So that's been my own journey of uncovering that throughout time. It's been a lot of me search. So I'd moved back to the West Coast. I'm like, well, I have it enough together, which lasted
a day.
Probably like 9 months. And it was a mess over the 9 months. But we weren't married at the time, but she decided to leave me again. And so I collapsed. And then that's when I was really suicidal again. And my therapist at that time said I needed to go to IOP. So I did a stint in IOP for almost 4 weeks through the holidays, through like Thanksgiving and Christmas. And then after that, there was like 3 or 4 months passed when I started a DBT training course for 6 months back at the hospital, like the same hospital I did IOP at.
Do you want to explain what DBT is in case anybody doesn't know?
It's dialectical behavioral training.
It's learning various tools in a sense, right?
Yeah, it's very tool-based for trauma responses in particular and emotional management. It's based off of mindfulness and like meditation. So being more present in the moment and being aware of the sensations that arrive in you in order to use tools to calm you down, basically regulate your nervous system is what it's doing. To get you in a more balanced emotional state so you're not so reactive. And it's a foundation to start with. It is not in-depth therapy.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So without it, though, I mean, I thought it was kind of useless, like, for real, in a lot of ways, because after I'm done, I wasn't healed, right? And I didn't feel better. But it was the first time that I was starting to use mindfulness in my everyday practice. And becoming more aware of what was going on internally inside of me. So that was the moment. So really like 6 years ago was the turning point of becoming more aware, but I was still a mess.
Was there a realization of trauma at that point, or that it was childhood related?
Yeah, it was definitely a realization that because of the environment that I grew up in, my parents verbally and emotionally abused me, but I didn't understand the depths of that. I understood the effects of it because of just the emotional overwhelm of feeling like I am literally burning and on fire and wanting to die because the sensation is so much and it's so intense, and I didn't have anything to help me out of that space. And then constantly feeling like I'm going crazy, like no one else understands this. I'm only going to be abandoned. I will never have any intimate relationship connection on a soul level because I don't have the ability to do so. And that was heartbreaking to me. And so, what would be the point of going on? There was no hope, right? It would come in pieces, like hope would come in pieces, but the majority of it was very hopeless. And at the same time, too, during this process, I was drinking still. And then there was a year period where I quit drinking during that, after I did the DBT and stuff, but I stopped doing that and then was addicted to distraction with playing video games and then not doing more of the work that I needed to do on myself, right? And then I disassociate a lot and not realizing I was disassociating for so long.
Probably didn't even know that word.
I didn't know that word. And yeah, none of the like the in therapy, no one ever really picked it up or ever brought disassociation up to me either. So yeah, it really was up until like 3 years ago now at the divorce of I really have to change at this point. And I'd still messed up after our divorce. During that process, I was drinking. And then I had a major collapse of like drinking for a week solid when I had to stay with one of my parents and they didn't do anything. But I was around them and the trauma responses were coming back. And I did, again, I wasn't realizing that there were small parts of me that were severely activated. And coping with drinking was my way of survival, but also a way of severe disconnect and disassociation. Of just being numb to it all. And during that week, pretty much almost died again from drinking and just witnessing like them watching me do that to myself. At that time, I'm 35, 36 years old. And so I'm a grown man in a grocery store with one of my parents. And my ex-wife wasn't talking to me because I really like upset her, and she, yeah, it was completely understandable, but my heart was completely obliterated and I was fractured and I was in the grocery store and I just start pouring crying because my parent asked like, hey, what's wrong with you, or like what's going on, and I'm just like telling her this and I'm like just start pouring crying and they're like, don't do that. And so it's like this happened 50 million times as a child. Right. My emotions are too much. They're too big. There's no one there to handle them. So stop that because I can't handle you. Right. And so in ways, it was a blessing to me of being around my parents because I had moved away when I was 21 years old, to get as far away from them as I could. And I hadn't experienced them face to face. There was times, right? But during that time, I was more awake. And so really being able to process of it, like, oh, okay, if this is happening now, it definitely happened in your childhood. Because a lot of my childhood I blacked out. Like I have no memories. There are very, very few memories that I've had to work very hard for them to come back.
Was there the realization in while you were actually at the grocery store, like in the moment, or was it in hindsight?
It was in hindsight
Okay.
because I was so like in an emotional state, my prefrontal cortex was completely offline, so I couldn't make anything rational of what was happening. But yeah, afterwards, able to process of wow, okay, that's not a one-time event, right?
So when that happened, was that in the 3 months that you went back, or this was a different time?
No, this was after I had gotten divorced, like I didn't know what to do with my life. And so I moved back there and I was there for a year. Yeah.
Okay, I was getting confused because I didn't know about the 3 month part. That was in your 20s,
That
right?
was whenever I was
Suicidal.
33 years old. And so this was 3 years later when I was like 36. I went back for a year, not knowing what to do with my life at all. I had no help. I had no mentors. I had no friends. The only people I knew were my family, and they were no help at all. Like, they had never asked me anything about the marriage or anything about me personally. That's the thing. Like, it's so disconnecting. It doesn't even make sense. So I was basically on my own in a trauma response of just being extremely reactive, looking for a place of safety because I knew, like, on my own, I didn't know what to do. And I was scared of being alone, like, of self-harm and what I would do. And also just didn't feel like I had the ability to do anything. Right. So yeah, at that point, I'd stopped drinking and then really focused on my internal world. And for months of doing a lot of sitting still and using meditation, of like going back to DBT, of mindfulness and meditation, of forming a practice every day of sitting for hours and just grieving the relationship that I'd lost, grieving the re like not having intimacy, and then grieving my own life of everything that was stolen. And out of the grief and through the suffering of facing that and feeling that inside of my body and not running away, that was the door that opens up being able to be curious about the deeper work that needed to happen and how I could go about doing that. So
Were you still living there at the time?
it was hell.
Talk about the unfolding process. Like, what were the ahas and the connections and understanding about why you were the way you were as far as your childhood experiences?
Seeing both my parents acted differently. They were both emotionally disconnected, so emotionally disconnected and shut down. They live in like a dissociative state and they're so disconnected from their body, they're never there and present. The other one is like that too, but they get extremely angry. And so I was able to witness both of them doing these things and these emotional outbursts of anger and not being able to handle the situation. Whenever I'm a 36-year-old adult. So those were huge ahas that I'm not making this up in my mind of thinking back in time. Because I would also bring up memories of me that were very traumatic for me. Like, for instance, one is I'm probably 12 or 13. And I was at the lake with this youth group outing gathering thing. And my father was always there with me with everything that I did. So I was like in scouts, in church, in everything. He was there. So I was never away from them. I was kept in a bubble and in a container. Now I didn't understand why until later. But anyway, at this outing thing, I was in at the end of the dock and I ended up holding this girl's hand. And he blew up in rage and started stomping around on the dock and yelling and completely humiliated me. And so the message I got was holding someone's hand or being affectionate in any physical way at all is like the worst sin, the worst thing a human could do. So that's one instance, right? I was very shamed for emotionally expressive. My parents, I've never seen them kiss or hug or anything, and they didn't talk and they never sat on the couch together or nothing. So that's the And I'm the only child too. Kind of wonder that we could bring that up too. So I'm trapped inside of an environment where I never saw any sort of emotional connection, verbally or physically. So the aha moments, like when I lived there, was seeing them either completely emotionally shut down or blow up and be explosive to me as an adult, and not being able to handle an adult conversation. And I would bring up instances of like, this happened to me in childhood. Oh, I don't remember ever that happening. That didn't happen. So there was no dialogue about it. There was no conversation. Like, both of them want to stay in denial about things. There was an instance, like a major instance that happened with me, because one thing between my ex-wife and I was physical connection, and then feeling touch and moving back from that, of being afraid of it and terrified of it in a way, even though internally I longed to be connected. And so there was a lot of either thinking something happened to me as a child in an abusive way, or that I was either homosexual or something. And it was like there was so much shame inside of me that I held on to that because I didn't understand the reasons why. And not understanding that inside of my body, and see, I consider the body as the subconscious. So my subconscious was holding on to these memories that my conscious was not aware of, right? It's implicit memory. And so when I was there in back living with my parents, one of my parents, I was searching through a box of pictures because I was trying to uncover my childhood of a picture, a photo, something of me as in childhood, because I don't have pictures. I don't have any evidence about things. So in this random box of picture, I found one that was quite disturbing whenever I was very young. And it was a very provocative picture. I won't go into more details than that, but it's not a picture back, especially regardless, but it's on film too. And I showed that to my parents separately because my parents are divorced. So I showed it to them separately, and the way that they both reacted to it was complete denial, and it's not a big deal. However, the body language explained it all to me, right? They didn't have to verbally say anything. Showing the picture to my ex-wife, she just wanted to vomit because of the intensity of it, that you would never do that to a child. You would never take the photograph. And so I asked for the videotapes of recording, and they said that they had to watch them first before I could watch anything. And so that was another red flag for me. And there's other instances too of things that happened in my childhood where I saw evidence being discarded. We'll say it like that, like the evidence was discarded. And I remember that visually, like these are imprinted memories inside of me. And now I can think back of, oh, that's what that was. Like there was more photographs, there was more things. There was so much in my life that thinking that I'm crazy and I'm making things up in my mind that come back either in dreams or in memories. They come in flashes. It's like if you were to take a roll of film and you were to put the pictures together and made like a flip book out of it, like old cartoons, right? And they formed a movie scene. But if you just take one individual scene out of there, it doesn't really make much sense to you. You get the scenes in like a flash, an image, because what happens is different parts inside of me are fragmented and they hold the memory sections of them. Because if it was all stored all together, then I couldn't handle it. Literally, your body can't handle it. So it cuts it off into segments and stashes it up, right? This is where the form of like exiles come into place, because the exile will hold memories or body sensations that are so intense that your system can't feel that all the time. So therefore, the other parts bury that deep inside of you. Right? It's in a cellar locked up somewhere. It wasn't until I started doing more of like somatic experiencing work coupled with IFS of feeling it in my body, and where does the body sensation takes me? Because this isn't a logical thing, because again, it's not stored in your prefrontal cortex. Like your memory, it's very intelligent how it works. Because if it didn't do that, then it would really be hard to keep on living, yeah. Right? But breaking down the code and putting the pieces together, it is really done through the body sensations and where those sensations lead you into memory of when was the last time you felt this?
Mm-hmm.
When is the earliest time you could feel this? So, yeah. I mean, those were some moments there that it started clicking into place that I literally wasn't making things up, because I had physical evidence. No matter, and it wasn't just the physical evidence I could hold in my hand. It was the evidence that I saw throughout body language within both of my parents and what they were communicating to me without even knowing they're communicating it to me.
How did you respond?
One of them, I did get somewhat upset with them, and there was tension. But there was still a part of me that was fawning, and a mixed with a freeze part of shutdown and collapse. Because if not, too, it would have been really bad. Like, things would have been really bad for me. And at the same time, it's like parts of me want to shame those parts for doing that. But what happens is it triggers the smaller parts inside of me, right? And they're still your parents who, to you, whenever you're 3 or 4 years old, they are the world.
Yep.
So in that, it's like in that moment of like how I responded, I was time traveling again, of smaller parts were coming up and just shutting everything down of like, this is so overwhelming. Like, we're just going to make appeasement, even though parts of us are extremely rageful. Like Linda Tai uses the term annihilation energy. It's that anger that's so explosive inside of you for every time that your agency was taken.
Mm.
Right? It's like I felt that coupled with the dorsal vagal collapse of just freeze and shut down.
So when did you get exposed to IFS?
So I've been doing it for maybe a little over a year. I was exposed to it before then by Janina Fisher's work, Healing the Fragmented Selves of Trauma Survivors.
Mm-hmm.
She uses parts language, and she has her own thing called TIS. Mm-hmm. And it's for dissociative identity disorder patients.
Mm-hmm.
Her concepts of things, I just really connected to her. And then it started clicking that I already knew that I had parts. I just didn't know that that's what it was, because it was another like piece clicking inside of me of, oh, okay, you're not crazy. These things are real, and you're not going crazy. It's legitimate. And then, yeah, I tried doing it on my own, which was really difficult. And then I joined a group.
Uh-huh.
So I did like it was a men's work group. So there was like 6 men in a group with one therapist, and we did a 9-month program with that. So yeah, I mean, a little over a year, but roughly a year. It's just, I resonated with it on such a deep level.
So somebody is listening to this podcast right now. They're just only familiar with ACA. How do you explain to them the fragmentation of the self that occurs through trauma?
I mean, the aspect that a human being can only handle so much at one time. So the energy has to be dispersed somehow. Let's put it this way. Let's define trauma, because everyone's mm-hmm. going to define that a little bit differently. And so I like Linda Tai's explanation of this, and it's very simplistic in the aspect that it's not about the trauma. It's mm-hmm. about who was there or who was not there with you during the event. Without another individual there to co-regulate our nervous system and process what's going on, we're left stuck with all that inside of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to compartmentalize it to bear it at the time in order to keep living. You know, there has to be some sort of fragmentation of the mind.
And so somebody says, what does that mean? What does fragmentation of the mind mean?
Well, the energetic charge and the memory itself get split up, right? So the energy is going to stay inside of your body because you're not allowed to process it, you know, even if you do to a degree. And then the memory gets fragmented out and distorted.
Mm-hmm. As far as like the prefrontal cortex, like not making it into a whole memory.
Yeah, I mean, your prefrontal cortex goes offline, like yep. Dan Siegel explanation of flipping a lid using his hand, right? And so you're stuck with your emotional aspect of your brain, which is fight, flight, freeze, fawn.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to go into some sort of survival mechanism, depending yep. on the situation and depending on your previous experiences of that situation, of what you learned to do over time, what kept you safe before. Your mind is going to then go back and react towards that because your neural pathways have already been formed.
Mm-hmm.
It worked in the past, so you're going to repeat the same thing. If you're a fighter, you're going to fight it out, right? If you're terrified and stuck in a freeze, like a dorsal vagal collapse mode, well, that's what you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think of like really traumatic situations, losing your voice in that aspect, mm-hmm. right? Of like being mm-hmm. the speechless terror. And why does that happen whenever you literally can't scream out or you can't yell for help. And I believe it's called like the bronchia in your brain, like which controls your speech, literally goes offline. Like when your amygdala is activated to a degree. So the alarm system goes off and that there's danger. And then therefore that region of your brain just disconnects your speech.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You're not doing this consciously. There's no conscious mechanism. It's all subconscious and happen in a reactive state.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why a lot of people hold shame for whenever they are violated or something is taken from them. Their sense of agency is lost inside of them. They carry a tremendous amount of shame for not being able to fight off the situation or react to it. The interesting aspect, if like through case studies of people that do react in a fight mechanism, whenever a traumatic event happens like that, it's energy being discharged and displaced, they're much less likely to develop like PTSD symptoms after the event.
Because they're getting the energy out.
That's right. Like Peter Levine's work with somatic experiencing, right? And how he monitored animals and how they processed, you know, trauma throughout the day of
shaking it off.
Yeah, shaking it off. Like you can see a dog do this in a dog park whenever they get into an argument with another dog and they shake. With us as humans, we're never taught to do that.
Yeah.
And this is why we're not meant to be alone and meant to be in a herd. It's, you know, for forever and ever and ever, cultures have like ritualistic processes for processing grieving, like death and so on and so forth. Of doing rituals through dance, right? Through rhythmic beats and stuff mm-hmm. to get your body moving. And this is the bottom up work, not mm-hmm. the top down approach,
mm-hmm.
where the top down is more like cerebral, like where the CBT comes in the aspect or a meditation comes in the aspect and processing it. But you can't process anything until you dissipate the charge. And so from a bottom up approach of working through the body, and relaxing the nervous system and getting to a space in order to process what's actually happening to you.
Mm-hmm. When you said you go back to what's worked for you in the past, but is there any research on when a child first responds to trauma? Like when do we come in to this life with predispositions to particular trauma responses?
I mean, I think in ways, yes. And in ways, no. It comes from the like environmental aspects of what you learn as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the same thing in the debate of like, do people come into the world of being, you know, predispositioned to be addicted to certain substances over others, right?
Yeah.
I think it's called the epigenetics of like whenever they started researching after World War II and the Holocaust, the effects after that, and generationally speaking, the families were still had trauma because mm-hmm. of the previous generation carried the trauma. And this mm-hmm. is the lineage of trauma. So in that aspect, yeah, I mean, it does show up. Now, it's certain ways, like, are you going to freeze versus fight or run away? I don't know. Like, I don't know whether that's really developed more in an environmental circumstance, because going back to the aspect of attachment theory and dealing with whenever you're first learning to attach, as a very young child, in many instances, there is no mechanism for you to run away or fight.
Yep.
Like, a lot of times, your only defense is to freeze or fawn towards your caregiver. Because if you were to fight, more likely it would be more of a problem for you.
Yeah, I'd say so. Can you explain when in Janina Fisher's book, where she just talks about how we have to separate out from like this the bad child, like how the part of that is as far as like this internalizing our parents' mistreatment of us.
If you think back to actually being a child, the caregivers are your world. They're your only sense of safety and survival, and you will do anything for their approval, because you also need to connect on an emotional basis. And if you can't connect on an emotional basis, you have to make it up. You have to like form some elaborate fantasy that somehow they are good. Because if it's your problem, like going back to the bad child and focusing on you, right? If it's not your bad and your parents are bad, then really the world is just over for you. What hope do you really have at that point in time? If you're trapped with the worst people on the planet, how do you go on surviving? It doesn't really make so much sense, but if you look at it from a survival standpoint, where you're literally just trying to live, right? And so, if your parents were the threat to you, then you might as well just be dead. So you make it out that they are not the problem, that it's got to be you're the problem. Because how could it be that these people, are so terrible? It's all distorted thinking.
It's interesting too when you think about having parts of us developed as far as those who had subtle forms of let's say like emotional neglect. I think that could be hard for some people to grasp, you know. But obviously criticism is such a huge thing.
Yeah. I mean, think about it from the parents' aspect. All right. They have a child that's 4 or 5 years old, and the child is not wanting to do what the parent is asking them to do. The parent instantly feels like belittled, diminished, small, loss of power, loss of agency because their child's not listening to them. The parent is getting triggered at that point in time, because now they have tr time traveled back to when they were a child. That sense of anger that rises up within, and then in a flash, they either verbally start abusing the child by yelling at them, which is just as damaging as actually physically at some points, right? Depending on the individual. Because again, where was the other person helping the child regulate their nervous system? Where was the other person in the experience with the child? They weren't there. So, therefore, it's causing more trauma. Yeah. And it's like the brain really can't distinguish the pain difference between like an emotional and a physical aspect of things either. Like, it only knows like pain, the sensory inputs, you know what I mean? It's a very dynamic situation, and breaking it all down, it takes time. So, in the moment, you're left with literally just trying to survive the moment to get out of the situation.
So we understand like the aspect of like why the self splits off into other parts, but why is it like multiple parts? Like why are there so many parts? And for you specifically, with the various parts that you've been able to develop, have you been able to like pinpoint different ages?
As far as why do we have so many parts, I mean, I think it's the complexity of the human being and the complexity of the brain, which a lot of it we are still don't understand, and we're still, there's a lot that doesn't make sense. My personal opinion, I guess, of it of the aspect to really have to be able to co cope with so many different experiences and situations that have wounded us. We might go through, it's the same thing as like, siblings in a family, they experience situations differently. Some of them are very traumatized and other ones seem to have a semi healthy aspect of life.
Mm-hmm.
And how is that? Or they're traumatized in different ways, or they have their different coping mechanisms, right? Why isn't it all the same? Because everyone's unique in their own individual like ways. What's to really limit the splitting off of parts or the separation of parts? And then as far as the different ages, rely on what the parts inform me of their age and kind of drawing it back from memory. But really I rely on them to tell me especially their name, because I want them to have complete agency over who they are. And I'll classify them, but I won't give them like say a specific name. And yeah, generally they'll let me know their own age.
I think actually what would be really interesting is like talking about your process of coming to terms with your parts to do this.
For so long in my life, I've known I've had parts. I didn't know that's what they were. And I thought I was going crazy. And it's not always a voice, but it's thoughts and different feelings and different sensations and being very confused. A lot of it comes off as I'm not telling the whole truth. This was a big thing in the relationship, because when you get really close to someone, they know that you're not telling them something, or there's other parts of the story that you know. So coming to terms, the aspect, okay, that I have parts was a huge relief, because once I started hearing parts language, it opened up a whole new world to me, because it was no longer just in my own mind and in my own body. I wasn't alone. Just like when I first started doing like therapy work and realizing, oh, okay, this isn't all some evil thing. Because again, I grew up in a very, very, very small community in the South where the word like shrinks or quack doctors or it's all looked down upon as some evil terror, like really the worst thing ever in the world, right? So when I first encountered it, I was like, oh, I'm not alone. I'm not crazy. And that's what it was like for when I discovered parts, was a whole different dimension of that, of, oh, this makes total sense and resonates inside of me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big relief. And at the same time, I didn't realize how much effort it would take on a consistent basis to really form a relationship with them and to gain trust.
Yeah.
To be able to actually locate self and have self leadership and allow self to speak to the parts and not the parts talk to each other. But a big issue that I run into is the walls between the parts, and the parts don't know the other parts exist. The amnesic barriers of going back onto the express, like the spectrum of disassociation.
Yeah, I think like you explain that for folks who don't understand what you mean by this.
So like disassociation could be like you're driving your car down the road and your implicit memory that you recall, you don't have to pay attention to the car. You just drive the car and you get from point A to point B without even recognizing where you're going. Like you don't remember seeing the trees or the cars you passed, so on and so forth. You're in a disassociative state.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in a disassociative state when I wake up first thing in the morning and I have to go to a job I don't want to, but I have to get up super early. I'm already disassociated because I have to disconnect from my body, because my body's saying, hey, I really need more sleep. This isn't my cycle. I don't like this. I'm forcing myself to wake up to an alarm clock and get out of bed and go to work. That's a form of disassociation, to the point of disassociative as in you don't recall memory or gaps of time that you do things. I don't have disassociation to that degree of I know what I'm doing, like for the most part throughout the day and so on and so forth. But it's still on that end of the spectrum. And how I'd run into this too, of a lot of it, I didn't understand what was going on for so long, because what would happen is, for instance, doing like trying to map things out and figuring out what's going on in my internal world. What are my behaviors? Like I have this belief system. Why do I believe these things? Because of certain experiences I had, certain events I went through, so on and so forth. I would write write the stuff down. And what was happening is a part of me was writing it down and a part of me was writing down other things. And then I would forget about it and it'd be like notebooks of stuff. And it wasn't all together, but also I would totally forget about it. And my ex-wife would find this stuff and it's like, look, you know what's going on. You actually do a lot of, like, you know what's going on in your internal world. You know what you need to solve and fix. And it was another layer of intense shame for me because I didn't know how to solve that, but also I didn't remember certain aspects of it. And it's like, well, then I'm lying or I'm keeping things and stuff. And to a degree,
like, genuinely didn't remember writing certain things down.
And so when I started doing parts mapping of, hey, this is the part when I encountered them, this is their name, this is their story, stuff like that. What I was ended up doing is really mapping out my entire story because the pieces started really clicking into place because the parts held the stories. That's when it started becoming exciting and terrifying at the same time, because the more you know, the deeper you have to go and the more opens up. So opening up Pandora's box, I'm not sure whether I can actually close the box.
Do you think that, just to pause in here, just because I'm not somebody that, maybe I do have a bunch of repressed memories that I can't remember, but the best of my knowledge, like, I don't think I do. But there's so many people that are in our community that can't remember things from their childhood. I just encountered it on Reddit. I just had somebody ask me, like, why can't I remember anything from my childhood? Do you think that the parts work is like a really big key component in addressing this?
I do. From what I've seen of working with other people with parts, with, like, within the group, they might remember aspects of it. They might not have a total blackout memory, but the parts recall it in their own distinct ways. And more importantly, how they feel about the experience and their perception on it. And that's what's important. Is it's not necessarily, you don't even have to remember everything to end up getting healing for what happened in the past.
Yeah, of course.
It's just about processing it.
Yep.
And so if you can access the part and how they feel about it, what their beliefs that they're holding on to about that particular event that happened to them, then you could process it with them by being with them and getting unburdened from that. For me personally, there's no way I would remember any of this stuff because I went down a rabbit hole with trying to understand repressed memory and working through my own dream work and keeping a, like, dream journal and writing down every single dream that I had. And, like, for the longest time, I didn't even dream. So when I started dreaming again, it was a whole new mind waking. But literally just keeping track of everything and writing it down and waking it up and just being really curious about what the subconscious is trying to speak to me about. The parts aspect and listening to what they have to say and allowing myself to feel what they're feeling is really what opened up the doors to my repressed memory of the things that happen. Because going back to, I mean, my view and intake on this too is, like, I look at it as in the fragmentation of the soul. And you could say the mind, it gets split off and certain things like that. But I really think it's a fragmentation, and certain parts hold aspects to the trauma, because if your system can't contain it, because it'd be too much for you to keep functioning with it. So it gets compartmentalized, right? Like, you can look at this in people that work in like paramedics and firefighters and police officers, and then people that are, you know, in war zones or refugees or any of these really high intense environments, they compartmentalize in order to just keep surviving. Right.
Yeah, like a fucking, like a cancer doctor for children.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, so that has to go on a shelf somewhere inside of you.
Yep.
It's just having access to that. So one thing that's really changed my whole way of this is because what I kept running into and what I was explaining things in my own internal world, because for a while, my internal world of where my parts lived was a prison system. It wasn't a home. It wasn't a nice place. They were very segregated off with hard walls and stuff. And it was really interesting because I had one part that could actually relay messages and go around and be communicative. And I thought this was really strange. And I thought I was going crazy.
Communicate to other parts or what? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, like kind of communicate to other parts and let me know what was going on. And then I read a book.
I just want to say that, like, if this was like 3 years ago, like when I started the podcast, like I would think all of this sounds crazy.
Yeah.
And I'm sure somebody listening does too, but like this shit's real.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I used to think it was, you know, completely out there too, and I wouldn't have believed it. I'm trying to find the name of this book, but I can't remember it. But it's about a very like high functioning individual who he was like head of some society thing, and
it's a true story.
Like, yeah, like really had a lot of money and all this stuff, but he was diagnosed with dissociative identity disorder, and this was like, I don't know, in the 80s or 90s or something, and he wrote a book about it. So anyway, he's describing his internal system, and it was this somewhat like of a haunted house type thing, and he had a part that could relay messages and stuff too.
Do you have memories that only one part has experienced
access to? It, yeah, I do. And to gain access to those certain parts, it takes a lot of work over time. Again, going back to the things add up, so sometimes it goes at a rather fast rate, but that depends on what container I'm in and how safe I feel. This is why therapy is so important, as far as the most important aspect is being able to attune with the other person and feeling that sense of safety and security. Because with that, regardless of like what modality you're using, you're never going to get to deeper layers with inside of yourself, because your most important thing that your mind is doing is trying to keep you safe. So if you do not feel safe on a subconscious level, you are not going to get there.
When you started this journey 3 years ago, did you have any idea who you were? Did you have any idea what you liked, what you didn't like? Do you spend any time considering if you had a purpose?
I mean, I did know things that I did enjoy and like that were parts of me and different aspects. I really enjoy photography, for instance. That's a known. I really love music. That's a part of me. I really wanted to help other people. I really wanted to be a husband and father and have my own family and not only take care of them and provide for them, but be an emotional foundation and a sense of safety and security to protect them. Like, that's a big drive and desire for me, right? These aspects of me I knew, but a lot of me was still unknown and not yet discovered because of the lack of identity. Going back to the idea of the confusion and chaos that lived inside of me, of the polarization of parts, of certain parts want certain other things, certain parts have their own beliefs and they're terrified and live in fear because of things, and they keep, you know, self from actually obtaining goals of what they really truly desire in life. I couldn't put that into language or like really explain that clearly.
Yeah,
but I felt it all. I spent 15 years doing the same thing as far as a job goes. But I had known for years and years and years that I wanted to do something else. It was just terrifying to do something else and make some sort of an income. And 6 years ago, when I was doing the dialectical behavioral therapy, that group, like, I remember talking to one of my therapists there and explaining to them, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but when I get to a place of being healed to a certain degree or whatever, I want to do therapy work, because it opened up this aspect inside of me of reality, of how much like I came alive with just trying to understand so much about this, because I was trying to understand myself, like going back to the me search aspect of it. And how much I wanted to also like understand my partner, understand what's going on in their world. How do they operate and function? Because it's what's been kept from me all my life, was being able to connect to other people and to connect to myself. And so I was fascinated with this of, I want to learn everything I can about psychology and about people and why they tick? What makes them do these things? Why do they have these feelings and have their beliefs? And yeah, so part of me came really alive there of wanting to shift, of like knowing, having an idea of, okay, this is what I want to do in some aspect. I just have no idea what that is or how to get there, or even if I could do it, feeling so I've, at that point, it was like healing and being able to get to a place inside of my life of having some stability inside of myself was like so far down the road, right? Yet I remained hopeful that that time would come. And yeah, that was 6 years ago. So it's been a little while. And at the same time, I'm thankful that it's not 20 years ago.
Well, that's how it goes. It takes some time. I think I've shared it on the podcast like early on. I heard this quote and it was, where passion, purpose, and skill collide, true bliss resides. And I thought about it and I wrote down like what I felt like my greater purpose was, like what I'm passionate about and what do I think are my unique skills, what makes me me. It was interesting how like everything that I wrote down then doing this, it like checked all the boxes. So I'm curious for you, what do you think when I say that? What do you think your purpose is?
I mean, for me, it has been to be a therapist in some sort of dynamic way, somehow or another. And throughout my own journey of trying to find therapists to work with, a lot of it has been, I've not had health insurance. I only had health insurance for a time. So a lot of it's been all out of pocket to pay for therapy. And then other aspects of it is to be able to find therapists to work with is a nightmare.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And to find therapists to work with how you are, and especially being like accurately informed with trauma, and it's just a nightmare. And the system itself, how it's set up, just did not really function well for me as far as the healthcare system. Because I spent over 10 years in and out of therapy and the hospitals, and I didn't really get much of anything that I truly needed or that could help me in like a substantial way.
Yeah,
I did in aspects of it, and I am thankful. So wanting to figure out what can I do to create and be a part of the system without being a part of the system and of how it functions.
Yeah.
The other aspect of my journey is finding men's groups that weren't, like, when I looked them up, there's no room, or it's booked up and there's not a lot of stuff for men. A lot of men don't go to therapy. And so how do I get involved with this? What is my part to play in this? I look at it like a world at war, and like, where's my role to function? And so the other aspect of it too is I wanted to be a part of the community, as far as I wanted to be a part of the healthy healing community. And what I mean by that is the therapeutic community that's kind of has their wits about themselves and on the right path of doing this work. And
yeah, and in it for the right reasons.
And in it for the correct reasons, exactly. To genuinely help people. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be a part of that community because these are my people, of like, they speak my soul language, where we don't have to interpret each one another. We just naturally exist and we're coherent. I needed that, you know, instead of like that quote of like, don't spend a lifetime translating your own soul. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And so part of it is, this is my community of people, of whenever I've found genuine people that want to heal and to give. And then also my own desire of want to give back, because so much of me was gained through my own searching and applying myself and then figuring out what doesn't work and what works for me. Instead of being like led by a therapist of like, hey, do these things, this, you know, so much, a lot of it was my own path to take, my own research, my own ways. And so that led me to wanting to do some type of group work with men. The other aspect of it is I followed a men's group for years, for like over a decade, of it's called Wild at Heart, and they have like men's retreats and stuff. And I always wanted to be a part of something like that. And so basically there's not enough out there. So it led me to, okay, well then you need to create something. If it's not there for you, then you're going to have to make it, or somehow collab, or make, like, basically. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, in the past, I would have never thought was possible because my, you know, my freedom inside of myself and my authenticity was so held captive by all the trauma and being held down in chains. And so anyway, it led me to I took a class from Linda Tai and absolutely loved it. And when I was in her class, there were several people who were taking a trauma coaching course in which I'd thought about doing some sort of coaching course, but then realizing that, yeah, like I could be a trauma coach. And like one of my therapists is a genuine therapist. Like he's a licensed therapist, but he's a coach because he's out of state. Like he's in another state. So he's my coach, right? I'm like, this is ridiculous just how the world is shifting and like shifting and changing. And like a lot of people aren't going back to go to school forever and get a master's degree and all this stuff. And I didn't want to do that because, again, I'm not part of the system. And a lot of stuff of what they learn isn't about
It's
trauma anyway. Like, for instance, they get like, if they're lucky, they get a day training on what dissociative identity disorder is about. When I just think that is a laughing joke of how much disassociation is with people that deal with trauma, that it's not re that alone is not talked that much about the small like curls of disassociation, of like really being aware how it affects you, of going back to like watching small children and either like the still face experience and how they react or the straight situation. But the small cues they give off in their body language, it's like, can you pay attention to somebody from the outside looking in when you're dealing with a client of saying, okay, it's possible that they're disassociating right now because it just clicked, they just went somewhere. Like being able to bring them back and saying, hey, where did you go? Like, what's going on inside of you? You see what I mean? I going to school and not being, it just wasn't my path. So,
I feel the same way.
yeah. So after I took the class with Linda Tai, and which I highly recommend if anybody, it's they're super cheap. She is a phenomenal teacher, and she does I think she does sensory motor. She's in a program with Bessel, like a collective. And so they do like online workshops and classes, and it's recorded, but it's also like live events too. And so I did the live thing with them, with her. But she's just a phenomenal teacher. So maybe like 16 months ago, almost a year and a half ago, of like really getting serious of what am I going to do with my life? What is my calling? What is my gifting? What am I, you
Passion,
know,
purpose, skill.
exactly? And it's so, a lot of it too is so far out there that I'm like, I can't do this. I don't have the skills to do this. This is not, I don't know how to do this. And that just living in that fear and not willing to step out and try, that kept me down for a while. But really discovering, like processing and thinking about it. And then last summer of being like, no, this is what I'm going to do. I don't know how to do it yet, but this is the, I'm taking the steps in order to do this. So there, then I doubled down on taking online courses that I could take, and just it, basically investing more of my resources into that, until I, you know, researched around to figure out like, okay, what's a program that I could get involved in with to actually get some sort of certification and then start doing this for real. And yeah, through when I took Linda Tai's program, there was multiple people, and she recommended doing the International Association of Trauma Recovery Coaches. And so that's what I'm in now. And then within August, I'll be done and start that. And my whole thing is like, this is my journey to continually be involved in this with like deeper education. And it's a way to start doing coaching one-on-one with people. And eventually I want to do, again, going back to the group aspect of things, and especially with IFS, with the presence of self, is when you do it collectively in a group, it's not just the facilitator being in self and bringing that self energy, or from a polyvagal lens of the ventral energy of your nervous system and regulating the client and having that attunement and the safety. But when you do it in a group and you get multiple people that can be in self and have a very grounded presence, it's very powerful for the person that is actually experiencing, like doing the work. It's the collective energetic experience. It's a deeper dynamic. I've had experience of it that I don't know whether I could have gotten as deep as I'd gotten if it wasn't for a collective group of people doing the work in a safe container with me that I trusted.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you look at this throughout, again, throughout history, this is nothing new. People have, again, processed trauma, processed grief and suffering and despair and all this stuff with a group of people, not just one-on-one.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's, I would eventually like to do group work. The other aspect of this is I've been listening and stuff and where, when I work nonstop for years anyway. So when I'm at work, I'm constantly been listening to podcasts or books anyway. So the shift over to doing, it's like I work and yet for 8 hours a day, I'm listening to podcasts or books about trauma. I've set my life up in order to do that of like not climbing any ladder or building in my world of getting anywhere of like inside the worldly dynamics of financial security or so. I've sacrificed all that to excavate further myself of like where I'm, what I'm doing is more for the long game and the long yeah. term. And I had to build up a foundation.
Yeah.
So it's my parts are really starting to come alive in an enthusiastic new way and aspect because it's going back to the unburdening process and shifting over time of them. When that happens, they're becoming more of their authentic selves in their authentic roles and not a distorted way. And they're getting very excited because they can now engage more like play, no sense of perfectionism, being able to dance freely. There's this freedom of movement. And within that, this positive, energetic way of bringing that into other people, I come completely alive when I'm coaching and then I am the facilitator. It's a feeling I've longed to embrace and harness of having this deep sense of, okay, it's your calling, it's your journey, it's what, it's part of your story that's been shaped over time and how you've been molded and who you've been molded to be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a beautiful thing, like a flower that's blossoming and blooming and just being able to embrace that.
Mm-hmm.
As I'm sure like you've experienced, right? Mm-hmm. With starting all this, like it's scary and there's a lot of fear involved in it, but the more that you step up, and what I'm realizing too, a big thing that's coming up, that's been coming up for me recently is stepping up to the edge and figuring out that the edge doesn't exist, that it's literally an endless ocean. Mm-hmm. It's going back to the fear before the fear. I'm afraid of the thing because once I'm in the situation, I'm going to be afraid. And then finding out that the spoon bends, it's an illusion. It doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I get super excited and like, because it's throughout the journey of when are things going to change? When are things going to start getting better? I mean, shifts like dynamic inside of your life of when's uh-huh. your life going to start shifting and getting better,
uh-huh.
right? And I feel that tension and that shift taking place over time, like in the past, really over the past year, but even more so in the past like 4 months, and it just kind of keeps growing.
Yeah.
And there's also a letting go aspect too of mm-hmm. a surrendering aspect of the mm-hmm. unknown and what mm-hmm. the future holds and trying to hold on to things and letting that go.
Yep.
Because the grasping doesn't work. It's only going to cause more suffering. And the more I'm letting that go, I can embrace more of the journey aspect of it and the adventure, and inside the adventure requires risk. And no matter how much my mind wants to make up a story for the future and keep me safe, the more I can alleviate that and calm it down, the more the adventure story will just unfold naturally. I mean, that's when it's like the synchronicities that you start are more aware of and things start flowing and you're like, oh, this feels right because I'm now flowing with the river, not swimming against it.
Well, whenever you start coaching or whatever you start doing, we'll let people know. Did you see they started the IFS group in the community?
I know. I joined and I saw them like want to do like the a Zoom meeting thing. I mean, right now, like I'm trying to finish up the coaching aspect thing, which yeah. is, I think it's just another month. Basically, I have exams and I have to do my final of coaching, like coaching sessions that I have to show up to, and 5 other groups to show up to, and yeah, then turn in my stuff, which is literally this, it ends in July. So, before I commit to more stuff. Cause yeah, I totally wanted to be a part of the IFS group and do some sort of Zoom meeting and then like to talk about parts and like practice stuff.
Well, I'm excited for you. It'll be interesting to see how this
works. I mean, I'm excited because there's so much of me that wants to embrace this because I'm so ready for change and for to really step in.
Well, this has been amazing. I'm super this has fucking been amazing. Excited for you.
This is it only took me 3 times to actually do this thing.
That was longer than that.
3 times, but it's been months.
Yeah.
Months and months.
6 months. Finally, I had to go scorched earth on you.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And it's been way more exciting than I ever thought it was going to be.
What a journey.
Okay. It seriously has been a journey. What's holding on?